From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On this Labor Day, we'll take a look back at pivotal moments in Massachusetts labor history. The 1912 Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence.
It put in front of the nation this question of what our economy was like, what our industrial revolution at the turn of the 20th century was like.
And the first ever public employee union strike in 1919.
Police in 1919 never even got a chance to talk about their conditions and lost everything.
Also, fast forward to 2014 when Market Basket employees walked out in support of their CEO.
Corporate America should be taking a look at DeMoulas and using it as an example for their own businesses. Long-term investments for the long haul, customer value, and appreciate your employees. It's very powerful.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Hope you're enjoying this Labor Day. Today, we're going to take a look back at some important milestones in Massachusetts labor history. You'll hear about the Bread and Roses strike, the Boston Police strike of 1919, and more recently, the Market Basket strike. But before we step back into history, we want to take a moment to talk about how politicians are talking about and talking to American workers right now in the midst of this presidential election. So we turn to Professor Tom Kokin. He's co-director of the MIT Sloan Institute for Work and Employment Research, and he discussed with us what he thinks are the most important issues of this election and what American workers stand to gain or lose after November.
Well, the good news is that labor issues, the issues of wages and inequality, are on the table like we haven't seen in any presidential candidate's experience in recent memory. Now, I think they came on the table out of a sense of frustration, anger, but I think now it's time to shift to a more positive message and to talk about what we can do in the future. My message for this Labor Day is directly to the workforce. Get out there and ask these candidates harder questions. Don't let them give you empty rhetoric about supporting workers around Labor Day, supporting unions and collective bargaining. We know that's not enough.
Well, let's take a step back, because it seems that we've had such a long-term decline in union membership in the United States that regardless of what happens in the next 4 or 8 years, I mean, do you see anything reversing that trend?
Well, I see a lot of innovation in the labor force trying to find new ways to exercise voice and leverage. The fight for $15 an hour minimum wage is one example, because here you don't have formal collective bargaining, but you certainly have workers exercising their voice and influencing employers from Walmart to J.P. Morgan Chase to McDonald's to increasing their minimum wages in response. We need to extend our labor law protections to these new groups of workers so that they can't be discriminated, and let this open up our labor law to let new forms of representation emerge that fit the modern economy.
Well, really interesting, because, I mean, there have been so many discussions and will continue to be about, you know, the freelance economy, the
right.
gig economy, the fact that, you know, any expectations workers used to have about what it means to work for a company are radically changing. I mean, so can you tell me a little bit more about, where you would target certain aspects of U.S. labor law for upgrade or updating?
There are two areas. One is the large number of people who work in various contract jobs. Those who are maybe in franchises like McDonald's, or they're contracting out IT services to an independent organization. And so these people are in sort of a no person's land. They don't know who their employer is, and the labor law is ambiguous. So we need to extend rights to all of those workers so that they are protected and hold employers jointly accountable. Then in the gig economy, we have a need to extend the rights of representation to independent contractors who are excluded completely from the law at the moment. So if we open up our law and we say anybody who works should be entitled to the same protections that we afford to regular employees, and we allow those protections to move with the employee wherever he or she goes. I think we will begin to modernize our labor law. We'll open it up so people see that this gig economy or the contracting arrangements can work for them a little bit better.
Are you optimistic that that could happen?
I think it will. I think we will see in the next Congress debates about this. Whether we will see action depends on what happens, obviously, in the congressional elections.
Before we leave the subject of unions specifically, I do want to ask you, I mean, there's been decades-long debate about the effects that unions have on doing business in America, et cetera. And you know the arguments, and I'm just wondering, do you want to hear what your response is to them about, you know, for example, some economists say that dwindling union membership is good because it allows, for example, the labor market to be more flexible.
Well, there's growing evidence that a significant portion of the growth in inequality in income and wage stagnation is due to union decline. The estimates are between 20 and 30%. There was just a recent report out this week that shows that it affects not only unionized workers, but non-union workers who used to benefit from the spillover effects of unions. Around $150 billion a year is estimated in lost income over this time period because of the decline of unions. So there's no question that it affects workers and the workforce in general negatively. Now, does it affect employers negatively? Labor management relations vary greatly. Some very traditional, arm's length, rigid labor management, union management relations do reduce productivity. There's no question about it. That's why some employers oppose them. But we've learned over the years that if you build partnerships with your labor organization, like you see in some of the best airlines at Southwest Airlines, like you see out at Kaiser Permanente in the best healthcare organizations, you can get high productivity with industry-leading wages. But it takes a lot of work, and it takes shared concern, shared leadership, shared respect for both the workforce and for the business enterprise. That's the form of labor management relationship that we could create if we had more commitment to building a high quality labor management relationship that works for the economy.
Well, what about the charge or criticism that unions often stifle innovation? And I'm thinking, you know, one example which is very potent right now in Massachusetts is, you know, we have a ballot question coming up in November over charter schools and lifting the cap over charter schools. And and a lot of people who are in support of lifting that cap look at opposition from teachers' unions, for example, and say, well, you know, this is exactly what happens when, that teachers' unions have been the force that has limited innovation in education in Massachusetts. And you see they're opposed to lifting the charter cap. I mean, that's one very specific example, but I think it is, it is reflective of a broad-based criticism we've heard quite frequently.
There's no question that there's enormous need for innovation in our public schools. And there are two ways to get it. Denigrating teachers, as they have in Wisconsin, taking away collective bargaining rights, or we can get it as we're working here in Massachusetts with something called the Massachusetts Education Partnership. School superintendents, the School Committees Association, the State Education Department, the two teacher unions, and a number of us in the universities have been working together for about 4 years now to bring about innovation, and I think we have to continue that. That's what brought about the increase in the school day and school year here in Massachusetts, in Boston. The charter school issue is just one piece of this. There's some tension between the two. I think that's a healthy tension, and we just have to manage it and make sure that we respect teachers' rights in whatever form of school we create.
So finally, just to get us back to the presidential election, what do you think is at stake for American workers in this election?
Well, there's two things that I think are really critical. We need a president who is going to bind our society and bring groups together and demonstrate through role modeling and leadership and active involvement that people need to work together in our workplaces and respect each other. So I think that's number one. And number two is I believe that if we elect the right leaders, and particularly the right leaders in Congress, because that's where the bottlenecks lie at the moment, then we will make progress. And there's countless numbers of ideas. and local innovations that have sprung up. The minimum wage increases at the state level, paid family leave at the state level, sick leave at the state level, pay equity, as we have just seen here in Massachusetts in the last several weeks. And if we have the right leaders in Congress and in the White House, then I think we can take those innovative things from the states that have been tested, that have been tried, that can be tweaked a bit, and carry them to the national level to finally get our labor and employment policies to catch up with the changing workforce that we have, with the changing economy that we have, and prepare our workforce for the changes in technology that are coming ahead.
Well, Tom Kochan is co-director of the MIT Sloan Institute for Work and Employment Research. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Meghna, and happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day to you. When we come back, a look at two history-making strikes of the early 20th century. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
As we go marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray.
In 1912, Lawrence was one of the textile capitals of the world. Half of all the city's residents over the age of 14 worked in the mills. The giant wood mill was the largest cloth-producing factory on the planet, employing 40,000 workers. They came from more than 30 countries and spoke more than 45 different languages. And they worked in hot, dangerous, deplorable conditions, as described by actors reading oral histories in the short documentary Collective Voices.
Mills were damp and hot and noisy. The looms and machines were lined up row after row. The mill owners would speed up the machines. We had to work at two or more machines at a time.
Accidents happened all the time. A lot of people lost fingers and arms. Our hair got caught in the whirling bobbins. The air in the mill was filled with dust and bits of thread. It was hard to breathe. It made us sick.
So on January 12th, 1912, 25,000 workers walked off the job.
Our lives shall not be sweated. From birth until life closes, hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.
The Bread and Roses Strike of 1912 drew the nation's attention to the working conditions in the mills and to the concentration of wealth and power in the United States. Here's Robert Forant, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, who was then chair of the Bread and Roses Centennial Committee.
Once the walkout began, it became impossible, if you lived in Massachusetts and eventually throughout the country, not to read every day about the strike, about what was happening, about the poverty, about the living conditions, the working conditions that the strikers had been faced with. And so it put in front of the nation this question of what our economy was like, what our industrial revolution at the turn of the 20th century was like. And if you couldn't ignore it. You could try to deny the truth, but you couldn't ignore it.
We spoke with Forant on the 100th anniversary of the strike back in 2012. Ardis Cameron was also part of that conversation. She's professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine and author of Radicals of the Worst Sort, The Laboring Women in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Cameron began by telling us about the many children who worked in the mills.
Even if both parents worked, there was not enough income to support the entire family. So parents had to bring their children into the mills to employ them despite the laws. And the priests were very culpable in this. They helped them forge their identity cards or their birth certificates so that children 10 years old and 11 years old could enter the mills and be, argued that they were really 14.
Hmm. And Bob Forant, regarding the adults who were working in the factories, I mean, one of the most distinguishing things is, A, many of them were women, and B, it was basically almost all immigrants.
The city of Lawrence had attracted massive numbers of immigrants. A lot of mill cities in Massachusetts did during this time period. You could look at Fall River, New Bedford, Holyoke. They would be somewhat similar. But Lawrence seemed to draw more and more people. Employers actually sent recruiters to European countries, essentially with the streets are paved with gold sort of mythology.
Yeah,
come
I've seen,
to Lawrence.
I've seen posters, apparently, they put up in
yeah,
European cities.
Yeah, there's money
cities.
Hanging off trees and things.
Workers
and
walking out of factories with bags of money in their hand.
Yeah, and so, but at the same time, once people got here, I mean, just Lawrence had... of the sort of 10 worst countries, cities in the country, Lawrence ranked in the top 10 for infant mortality, for mortality under 5, and for just mortality in general per 1,000 people. So it was a really difficult place to live. The other cities on the list in the top 5 happened to also be Lowell, Fall River, New Bedford. So if you were a textile worker in Massachusetts in this time period that we're talking about, your life was grim, nasty, and probably short.
Artist Cameron, tell us, you've written a book about the women in particular who were working in the mills. Tell us more about them, because they were absolutely central to the Bread and Roses strike.
They were indeed. Keep in mind that the strike... began because the wages were being reduced, the numbers of hours, I should say, were being reduced by the state legislature from 56 hours a week to 54 hours a week.
And so, ironically, this was done as a progressive movement,
it was a progressive,
I guess,
Governor
to protect
Foss
women and children.
It was, in a sense. I mean, Governor Foss signed the bill because he really wanted to run for president, and he thought this would really be a progressive act to show his support for the union movement. But there was no compensation for the wages that would be lost during that reduction.
We're talking about workers who, at that time, were already earning only, what, $6 to $8 a week?
Yes, yes. The average for women is around $6.20 per week if they were working full-time, but the problem was... they weren't always working full-time, so that was another component to this.
And even with the reduced number of hours from 56 to 54 hours, they were still expected to keep up the same productivity.
That's right. They're also expected to swallow the reduction in wages. Mm. So it was really on Thursday when the Polish women in the Everett mill discovered their paychecks were short. They were furious, and they dropped their aprons, they picked up their picker sticks, they walked through the mills, they took their kids, grabbed them, walked out of the mills and shouted, "Let's go, this is it, we're not doing this." And they went back into their neighborhoods in the plains of Lawrence, and it was like electricity going through the neighborhoods because these women had walked out. That night was really full of meetings in the corners, in the grocery stores, and that was the beginning of the strike. The next day, 20,000 people, you know, turned up. It was huge.
Bob Forent, so artist Cameron has told us what precipitated the strike. What happened then, though? The backlash was fairly quick.
The militia, the mayor was at first of the opinion that he could keep order, but quickly it became apparent there weren't enough police officers, so the militia, so he petitioned the governor to send the state militia, the National Guard in terms of what we would call it today. And so fairly quickly, several regiments of the National Guard showed up in Lawrence. One of them, interestingly enough, was Harvard students who were let go from their final exams if they wanted to go to Lawrence and police the strike.
Apparently they were given credit for doing so.
They were given credit, yep. So, and interestingly, too, in Boston labor history, the Harvard students also show up during the Boston police strike in 1919, keeping order in downtown Boston. So... yeah. The militia came fairly quickly, made it really, really difficult for workers. The initial sort of way workers struck was they blocked the front doors of mills, and eventually the militia decided not to let workers congregate in front of the mills. So for one of the first times, as I understand it, in American labor history, a moving picket line began to form. And at one point, when you read the newspaper descriptions, there were anywhere from 7,000 to 10,000 people in picket lines marching all around, up and down to all the mills in Lawrence in a very sort of moving, obviously very powerful procession.
Artist Cameron, let me ask, you actually are one of the few people who have spoken with women who were members of the strike, and they have some amazing stories. I mean, you have one story of Syrian workers who were telling you how they would carry red pepper under their skirts in order to face the police.
Yes, one of the women that I interviewed, she was maybe 4'2", and she was with her grandchildren and her children, and she talked about how when the cavalry came, as Bob mentioned, they were on horseback, and they were often Harvard students, but they're also trained militia. By the way, the Wellesley girls came to town, too, and they worked in the soup kitchens to help the strikers. Mm-hmm. But these people were on the streets with no weapons at all, and these cavalry officers had not only guns but batons. So this one woman told the story about how underneath her cloak, she carried red pepper. And that had been passed around by the Syrian community. I think this woman was actually Italian. And she had to jump up. She was so short, and throw that into the nose of the horse. And that made the horse rail up. And why he did, the cavalry officer then was thrown off the horse. And then what would happen is the women would circle around the fallen cavalry officer, and they would strip him, ritualistically strip him down to his underwear, his long johns, and boo and hiss and shout and laugh and make fun of him as he was running out down the streets. And it was a way to shame him, and it was the only weapon they really had. But they were attacked fairly violently. In fact, I found many of these women's names in the records not only of the police and the records of the newspapers, but in the hospital records where they'd been taken for treatment.
Bob Forint, ultimately, Congress and the America as a nation focused in on the strike as it was going on, in part because of all those child workers who were in the factories in Lawrence. That got the president, William Taft's, attention at the time. But ultimately, tell us, there's just so much detail in this, but what happened at the end of the strike? What brought the strike to a close?
Well, the city fathers are upset with the fact that strikers are gaining publicity because they're sending children away from the city to homes where they'll be cared for during the strike. As artists said, people are living close to the edge when they're out of work so many weeks. There's no money. People don't have a bank book or a credit card. And so there are sympathetic families in Barry, Vermont, New York City, Philadelphia, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And children start to be sent in early February. And as that happens, the strike starts to gain more publicity as well. When they get to New York City, there's parades and whatever. And so the city finally decides, the militia finally decides, that they're going to not let kids leave anymore.
So they essentially arrest
on a Saturday. So the kids are leaving, and then they say, no more kids leaving. And so on a Saturday morning in late February, a bunch of kids are at the train station, about 40 kids ready to go to Philadelphia, and the militia and the police sort of ride in, and essentially there's a melee at the train station. Clubs are thrown, people are hit, women and kids are thrown in wagons and brought to jail and are arrested. And that gets even more publicity. The headlines in all the newspapers the next day on Sunday and then on Monday are just catastrophic for the mill owners. It's just incredibly bad publicity. That gets the attention, as partly I understand the story, at least, of the president's wife, William Howard Taft's wife. And eventually then Congress has hearings, and a number of these kids go to Lawrence. Camilla Tioli, one of the most famous of the really young people who testifies, is 14 years old. She's badly, badly injured in the mill. Has half of her scalp taken off in a machine. Her testimony just blows people away, and that really begins to put pressure on the mill owners to settle.
And ultimately, the mill owners do settle. They agree to an increase in pay. They agree to overtime, I believe, and to not retaliate against
not
workers
retaliate.
Who did
Eventually,
strike.
They do, sadly. Yeah. A few months later, they actually do retaliate. By October, things are really rough and tumble again. But at least for a time, this is a real important, significant win for labor.
As we go marching, marching.
Robert Forint is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Artis Cameron is professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine. She's also author of Radicals of the Worst Sort, Laboring Women in Lawrence, Massachusetts. They both joined us back in January 2012 on the 100th anniversary of the historic Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts.
Bread and roses, bread and roses.
Well, just 7 years after the Bread and Roses strike, another massive walkout became a major turning point in the American labor movement. September 9th, 1919, the Boston Police went on strike, the first ever strike by a public employees union. Several years ago, I met up with James Green, a professor of history and labor studies at UMass Boston, and a walking, talking encyclopedia of the working history of Boston. We visited two of the most important sites of the 1919 police strike, a pub in the South End, and the old armory on Arlington Street in downtown Boston. Yes, it's that building that looks like a castle, but is now an event space. This was one of the most important spots in the 1919 police strike. Why is that? What happened here?
Well, this was the headquarters of the 1st Corps of Cadets, a colonial militia, very elite group of people who sent units to the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. And after the Civil War, it became a kind of club for the Brahmins, well-to-do, highly educated people, and didn't really see much action. But they kept a militia unit that could be organized in emergency, and the police strike was such an emergency. And so when disorder spread in the streets, this building became a kind of beehive of military activity, and it did. World War I had just ended. Many of these men had served in the military in World War I, so they thought, well, we're having a domestic war on the streets. Actually, the police were behaving in a very peaceful way, but there was disorder and rioting and high anxiety.
So take me back to 1919. I mean, it's post-World War I, as you said. America's victorious in that war. But what was life in Boston like, and specifically actually for the police?
The war was a war to end wars, a war to save democracy in the world. And so working people were asked to make great sacrifices during the war. No wage increase. The Boston police hadn't had a raise in 5 years, which is one of the issues they had. Of course, wartime inflation was enormous, so this was the context.
I understand that the cost of living rose something like 76% over the time of the war.
Yeah, it did. And they had no mechanism for bargaining for wages. It was just simply, this is your wage. It set the police commissioner. His name was Edwin Upton Curtis. He was from a Yankee family, had very little contact with Irish Catholic working class people who composed the workforce. And he, 1919 was a frightening year. There were a lot of strikes. There was a fear of communism. It was a great Red Scare. And he was determined to keep control of his men and to be the boss.
I've seen a picture of him. He's got that classic handlebar mustache, but he was a pretty hard-headed guy.
He was. And the previous commissioner was someone, he was Irish himself and had a very good rapport with the police officers. But when Curtis came in, a lot of other things were going on. The police had been meeting in what they called a social club and had put some demands together. They were working a 60-hour work week and no raise in 5 years. They had to buy their own uniforms. They didn't get paid when they went to court. They didn't get paid when they stayed overnight at the station. So they wanted to talk to him about changing all this. And he refused. And then they'd start talking about forming a union. And he told them that was prohibited, that they denied them the right. And they said, that's our freedom of association under the Constitution. And he said, I'm sorry, you're public servants. You do not have that right.
So what exactly happened during the police strike at this spot where we're standing?
The governor, Calvin Coolidge, newly elected Republican governor, sent out the Metro Police Force to help. But he didn't send out the National Guard, which was crucial. The police commissioner had been promised that if there was a police strike, the National Guard would be here to preserve order in the streets. And Coolidge waited for 3 days to send in the National Guard. By then, some fairly serious violence had occurred. The media had turned completely against the police, not only blamed them for all the violence, but accused them of being in sympathy with the Russian Bolsheviks. This is the attitude that was prevailing during the Red Scare.
And in fact, as you mentioned, sort of the national media was looking at Boston at the time. I mean, I was reading in what was then the Philadelphia Public Ledger, they wrote that Bolshevism in the United States is no longer a specter. Boston in chaos reveals its sinister substance.
Yes. Yeah, the only way these journalists interpreted this, which seems bizarre in retrospect, is that these Irish Catholic police officers were somehow inspired by the Russian Bolsheviks. I mean, but that's kind of the way that people were thinking at the time.
Although we do have to remember the Bolshevik Revolution was very fresh in everyone's
memory.
It had just occurred,
and in fact, in 1919, the Comintern, Lenin had formed this worldwide organization to send out agents. And there was a lot of fear of communism. And by the way, Sacco and Vanzetti had been arrested that spring, and anarchists suspected of putting bombs in people's houses. So there were a lot of things for people to be afraid of. And they were afraid of the police because they thought, well, maybe they're part of this now. So Coolidge waited for 3 days and finally sent in ordered out the National Guard. And the 1st Corps of Cadets was based here, the motor unit. of the militia. So this was, as I said, a beehive of military activity. There's some of our public servants going to work right now. There's a fire station right down the street. So once the militia came in, these were, some of them were seasoned veterans, some of them were very green National Guardsmen, and there was some fairly serious crowd activity and rioting in South Boston. And they were threatened by a crowd, and they fired into the crowd and killed three citizens, which made South Boston enraged, and that still isn't forgotten there, by the way. It was kind of a strange replay of the Boston Massacre of 1770.
In 1919.
and people saw it that way.
Do you want to walk a little bit more towards...
I'll show you a plaque that was erected here by the First Corps of Cadets when this building became a national landmark.
So here we are.
Yeah.
We're right at the, actually, you're right. Right at the front door of the Smith & Wolinski restaurant. And actually, if you didn't know this plaque was here, you could usually just breeze right by
it. You would miss it, yeah. I mean, I wonder how many restaurant goers notice it. But there it is, and it tells you the story of the building. The armory was financed by the citizens of Boston, various military orders, historical societies, and the city of Boston. During the police strike of 1919, the First Corps acted as Boston's sole force to uphold law and order.
So, Professor Green, you know, the very fact, I find it significant that this is all happening right after World War One. I mean, 1919, the Great War ends in 1918. And Governor Coolidge goes so far, as I can understand, at calling the men who went on strike here, the police officers, traitors.
Yes, yes, yeah. Traitors to the city and to service. I think that many people viewed the police, including Governor Coolidge, as a civilian version of the military.
Hearing the governor call them deserter and traitors really wounded their pride because so many of them were veterans
from the First World War. Yes, yes.
And that they even, you know, sort of came up with this rallying response. I found a quote here where they said, "Not one man of us ever disgraced the flag or his service. It is bitter to come home and be called deserters and traitors. Right. We are the same men who were on the French front. Some of us fought in the Spanish War in 1898. Won't you tell the people of Massachusetts in which war you served?"
That's right. I don't think Coolidge did serve, yes. So that left a bitter memory in the communities where these people lived and worked because they were the cops on the beat. So when this happened to them, it really sent a message that people didn't forget.
A memory that still lives because many of those men were grandfathers of folks who still live here.
You can still go into places in the South Boston and hear about my grandfather who was a policeman and lost his job, and there's still hard feelings about it.
All right, well, so that's what happened here at the Armory, but you want to take us to another spot that's
significant
for the strike.
Yes, I want to take you to Fay Street in the South End.
So this is the corner of Dover and Fay Street?
Fay Street, yeah. This is now Berkeley Street. They changed the name of it, I think, because Dover Street was associated with an immigrant ghetto. Mary Anton, a great writer, wrote a book about growing up here and rising out of the ghetto called The Promised Land. It became kind of a minor classic.
Things changed so much as an O2 yoga center here.
Yeah, I know, yeah. So this Foley's Pub, until recently, I don't know if it's still there. I think probably not. There was a photograph of Samuel Gompers hanging over the bar, who was the president of the American Federation of Labor. And right in this alley here, we'll walk down there. I'll show you where the police met. Let's just see if this is open. You know, it might be.
Oh, there's a plaque here, too, actually. Oh, it was just placed here in 2009.
Oh, my gosh. So this is new to me. I didn't even see it.
So right outside of J.J. Foley's cafe, once pub, there's a relatively new plaque commemorating the Boston police strike.
Yes, look at this, 2009, erected by the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. No surprise there. Their parent group met here, you know, in 1919, and on this site at Dover and Fay Streets was the original location of the Boston Social Club, which was chartered by the American Federation of Labor August 15th, 1919, as a local to represent Boston police patrolmen. On August 26th, Union President John F. McGinnis and 18 of his newly elected union representatives were suspended.
by the police commissioner for forming a union in violation of department rules. September 9th, 1919 at 5:45, 1,117 Boston patrolmen left their posts in support of their leaders and went on strike. The rest of the plaque reads,
3 days of rioting ensued, ending only after a call-up of the National Guard. None of the striking police officers were ever rehired. So, at the Old Armory, we see one plaque showing the one side of the story. Here at J.J. Foley's pub, or cafe, we see the other side of the story of the 1919 strike in another in another plaque.
Well, this is what you call a place of memory. A place of memory, the Armory, for the elites of Boston who saw themselves as the guardians of law and order. And here, a place of memory for the working class people who saw themselves as the guardians of law and order. So, two versions of the same story.
I suppose the important thing to note, though, as you were saying, is that the Boston police in 1919, they lost.
They
lost
did.
It was
they lost the strike, they lost their jobs, and the cause of public employee unionism was set back many, many decades. It's not clear that what would have happened if they'd won, if other public servants were starting to think about organizing, but were trying to do it, the firefighters and the teachers. But after this, the door was closed until really the 1970s took that long.
It just occurs to me that, you know, history does echo the present day, because we're a nation which is still at war. In 1919, it was post-war time. Uncertain economy. There's this sense from political leadership, certain political leadership, that unions are, strangling the economies of states, if not the nation. Do you see similar echoes there?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm sure the public employees in Wisconsin are aware of this and see a direct line between what they're fighting for and what these men fought for in 1919, and all lost their jobs for that principle. I think from the point of view of working people who want unions, it's important to establish the point that you can talk and bargain, you don't always win. But the police in 1919 never even got a chance to talk about their conditions and lost everything. And that may be what will happen to 1,000 people tomorrow in Wisconsin.
Do you have any family connection to the police strike?
Not to the police strike. No, I'm actually, my family ties are in Wisconsin, so I'm from a union family from Oshkosh. My grandmother belonged to a garment unit workers union. I got an email from my cousin in Madison, who's a Catholic nun, and she said, "You won't believe what's going on out here. What would Grandma think?"
What would your grandma think?
Well, she would have been very unhappy with all this, because she was a very proud member of her union before she married my grandfather and had 7 children.
Wow.
Including my father.
Well, Professor Green, thank you so much for giving us this tour, not only of history, but also how history lives in neighborhoods around Boston.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guide, UMass Boston labor historian James Green. We spoke back in 2011 amid the battle between Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and that state's public employee unions. And this sad note, Professor Green passed away in June of this year from complications of leukemia. He was 71. Well, when we come back, when Massachusetts workers walked off the job in support of their boss. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Labor Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've been listening back to our favorite conversations about Massachusetts labor history. This next one has to do with a strike from the recent past, one unlike any ever seen in New England.
R-E-Z! R-E-Z! R-E-Z!
The summer of 2014, thousands of employees walked off the job and rallied outside of the Market Basket headquarters in Tewksbury. They weren't protesting poor work conditions or asking for higher wages. Instead, workers went on strike in support of an executive. They wanted ousted CEO Arthur T. Demoulas back in charge. The company hemorrhaged millions of dollars in the 40-day standoff as employees refused to work and customers boycotted. By the end of August 2014, Market Basket shareholders approved an agreement to put Arthur T. back in charge, buying the company from rival relatives, including his cousin Arthur S. Here's Demoulas speaking to employees in Tewkesbury after the agreement.
And words cannot express how much I love you. And may we always remember this past summer, first as a time where our collective values of loyalty, courage, and kindness for one another really prevailed. And in that process, we just happened to save our company.
It was an unprecedented walkout. Store employees had successfully challenged the corporation's board. And after the walkout ended, we spoke with Ted Clark, director of Northeastern University's Center for Family Business, and with John O'Day, manager of a Market Basket store in Wilmington.
Things are going fantastic. It's great to see the consumers back. It's also great to see the kids back. You know, they enjoy working here. It's a great atmosphere. It's good to see them all back. And the customers are fantastic. We thank them for all their support. Without them, this never would have been possible. You know, it's a great business model, and I think the customers know that.
Well, tell me, how long is it going to take to get everything back on the shelves and in the aisles of the stores? I mean, I know a lot of trucks were on the move today, but I've been hearing it's going to take a couple days before everything's back in the stores. A
couple days. You know, we're getting fish delivered direct possibly today. We got a full trailer of paper delivered today. Produce will be delivered first thing in the morning. Meat cases about 75%. Dairy, we're waiting for yogurts. But the rest of the aisle is probably 60%. Deli department's about 60%. Bakeries about 75%. Kitchens probably 25%. Mm. Within a couple of days, we should be back up to, you know, close to 75%.
Yeah. Well,
all day weekend.
Mr. O'Day, if I might ask you, can you just tell us really why was this so important to you to be one of those people who risked everything in support of a CEO? I mean, obviously, Arthur T. Demoulas has got a lot of loyalty and many, many people love the way he's run this business. But, you know, it takes something special to say, I'm going to risk my job for this company. Why'd you do it?
It's a great business model. You know, to see what Mr. DeMoulas and his family has done for these towns, for individuals. We've had a great lifestyle. We've worked hard. We've passed it along to these kids, to the full-timers, to the managers. You know, we care about the customer. The customer is what's most important to us. You know what I mean? We knew with the if things went the other way that we didn't think it would be beneficial for the consumer or the employees.
Yeah.
Therefore, we thought it was the best stance to take. We took our chances, and thank God it worked out.
John O'Day is the manager of the Market Basket in Wilmington. I know you've got a busy day and a busy afternoon ahead of you with a lot of customers back in the store, so thank you so much for joining us.
We thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, let's turn now back to Ted Clark, director of Northeastern Center for Family Business. What do you actually think is the biggest challenge in front of Arthur T. Demoulas now? You know, everyone's riding high on emotion today, but he's got to run a company starting tonight, I guess, or starting this moment.
Two things. First, the debt that he's going to have to service that he's, from my understanding, he's never had to service debt, and particularly of this amount, $1 billion, in my book, is a lot of money.
Out of the $1.5 billion deal
overall. Yeah, it's a $1.5 billion deal. He'll have to service $1 billion in debt, and that'll be a change to the structure, and that could have a huge impact on the business model. And the other part of the puzzle is now, in some ways, he's traded one group of owners for another group of owners with $500 million in equity financing as well. So typically, outside equity investors are looking for an exit strategy. They're not in it for the long term, like a family member might be. And so he's probably going to get a lot of pressure from a group that want another exit strategy, and he may have to start looking for another $500 million
soon. So this is one of the ironies of the deal that was struck last night, because if I remember correctly, one of the major reasons behind the initial employee protest was when the board started talking about what was next for Market Basket. After ousting Arthur T. Demoulas, they were looking for the kind of investors that employees didn't want, but now they have those people in the mix.
Yeah, that is kind of ironic. And it may actually, you know, not be as favorable for RDT, potentially, just for the fact that although he did have a very contentious relationship with the other side of the family, this type of group is probably very professional and expects information. They're looking for something to occur within a relatively short time frame, I would assume.
Right. And so that, and as you're saying, that in and of itself could have a profound effect on the very business model that these employees were protesting to defend.
Exactly. I think there'll be a lot of pressure for returns, and there'll be a lot of pressure for bottom line results from professionals who will be expecting answers on a regular basis. That's an assumption that I have.
Let me take a quick call here. Laura's calling from Worcester. You're on the air, Laura.
I just wanted to say I'm so inspired by what's happened. I've been a Market Basket customer for many years and boycotted like everyone else. I think Americans really needed this win this time. It just shows us that when we do rise up, when we believe in something, we can actually get something done and make a difference. I'm just really in awe of everything that's gone down and can't wait to get back to Market Basket.
Laura, thank you so much for your call. We had a tweet come in from Beth Brosnan as well, who echoes that thought. Beth tweeted us, "Just went by my local Market Basket, bought a bottle of champagne and gave it to the staff. All businesses should run like Market Basket." Ted Clark, I think this is actually a very important point because we are living in an age where working people for some time, you know, it can be said they have been looked upon as easily cuttable assets by major businesses and corporations, or that it's their wages to go first before profits do. And here we have, you know, those working people speaking back. I mean, I really do get a sense that there was a message that they wanted to deliver, not just to the board and shareholders of Market Basket, but to American business overall. And that's one of the reasons why this has resonated so deeply.
Oh, I agree 100%. They really, I think, helped make the sale occur. Without them, there may not have been the pressure to make this happen as quickly as it did. So, you know, you really have to give the employees a lot of credit, the customers a lot of credit.
Do you think this is a message that, is going to reverberate beyond the Market Basket story, beyond here in New England? Are business schools looking at this and saying, this is more than a case?
One of the things I've always believed, and I always say over and over and over, there's a lot of things that corporate America could learn from a family business. And this is one of those things. When a family business works well, they work very well, and they can be unbeatable. They can be in it for the long haul. They can get to zero debt and operate with an understanding that if we keep debt down, we can provide value to the customers, we can provide value to the employees, and it could be a model that corporate, you know, the traditional shareholder company finds very difficult to beat. Corporate America should be taking a look at Demoulas and using it as an example for their own businesses. Mm-hmm. Long-term investments for the long haul, customer value, and appreciate your employees. It's very powerful.
Well, speaking of those customers, I mean, everybody today seems to be very confident that the company can win all its customers back. Do you share that confidence, or is there any aspect of the past 6 weeks that might have shaken the customer base a little bit?
I think the customers that shopped at Demoulas will most likely go back. I think the ones that didn't shop at Demoulas will have to go check it out at least once or twice to see what it was all about. You know, if you look at the positive goodwill that the employees express, that the customers express, you got to think that this is a coup for, you know, although it was probably a financially painful coup, it was probably a coup long-term for relationships with clients.
Yeah. Who is the real winner here? Because, I mean, today all the coverage is Arthur T. won. He's got control. He and his sisters have control of the entire company now. Mm-hmm. The employees won, et cetera. Is that the case? Or, you know, did Arthur S., his cousin, also come out as a winner, even if not in the public eye?
Well, I guess the way I would phrase that is not who won or who lost. I'd ask the question, did the people involved achieve their goals? I believe, yes, they both achieved their desired goals. But in many ways, I actually think Arthur S. achieved his goals to a higher degree. He was probably going to struggle to sell that company to any outside investor as long as his cousin was there. He had to either get rid of his cousin or sell to his cousin. So he was able to sell to his cousin at full price. From the reports in the past, it had been that Arthur T. had desired to buy controlling interest.
Right.
Not necessarily half the business.
Now he's got the whole thing.
Now he had to buy the whole thing. And I can't imagine that he really wanted to absorb $1.5 billion in debt and equity. So that's going to be a struggle. I think long term, it'll work out fine for him. But short term, I don't think it was necessarily what he wanted to happen.
Ted Clark, director of Northeastern University's Center for Family Business. We spoke with him back in 2014 at the end of the Market Basket Walkout. Well, that's it for this Labor Day edition of Radio Boston. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We have some incredibly hardworking producers on this show: Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. Tim Skog is our technical director, and our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.